there. Welcome to Life Matters. Yes, Natasha Mitchell joining you across the nation on ABC RN, internationally too on Radio Australia and the ABC Radio app, and as a podcast. We're everywhere. And the images of Melbourne Cup winning jockey Michelle Payne planting a big smooch on the cheek of her brother and colleague Stevie's cheek, yes, will have reached far and wide too. People the world over will have heard her triumphant speech telling the chauvinists, as she described them in her industry, to, quote, get stuffed. Whatever you feel about the horse racing scene, it's clearly a win for women in the racing industry. It's clearly a win for disability advocacy too. Kicking off your morning with a mystery sound. Any idea? Any idea what that incredible, incredible beast is? It certainly captured the conviction and the imagination of Tim Faulkner. He's just been named Australian Conservationist of the Year. He too reaches millions worldwide with his popular TV show, The Wildlife of Tim Faulkner. His wildlife unleashed on the airwaves on Life Matters this morning, irrepressibly passionate. First, though, over the weekend, Labor leader Bill Shorten called for the voting age to be lowered to 16. What's your response to that? Shorten said that if people this young can drive, work, pay taxes, then they should also have a say in who runs the country. Proponents of reducing the voting age say that it will boost youth engagement with politics. Others, though, like the ANU's Professor Ian McAllister, are more sceptical.
Well, I think there's a variety of arguments in favour of lowering the voting age. One is equity, another is that it would increase political participation among the young, and the third one is that younger people today are more politically knowledgeable and mature than they have been in the past. We looked at all of that in the Australian Election Study surveys that we conduct, and we really didn't find any particular evidence to support that.
That's Ian McAllister. He's Professor of Politics and International Relations at the ANU, speaking on RM Breakfast with Fran Kelly earlier this week. And as you just heard before the news, Fran Kelly herself is sceptical about whether or not 16-year-olds should be given the vote in this country. The thing is, adults do a lot of talking on behalf of teenagers, putting words into their mouth. So we wanted to ask two politically engaged 16-year-olds what they think about this proposal. Both write regularly for national newspapers as political commentators. Rosina Yadav is a Year 10 student at Merriweather High School in Newcastle. She's written this week for the Fairfax Press on the voting age issue. Caleb Bond is in Year 12 at the Heights School in Adelaide, in the thick of exams, in fact, as is Rosina. So thanks for making the time for us. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Rosina, Federal Finance Minister Matthias Cormann says this proposal to lower the voting age is a gimmick. Do you think it is?
I certainly do not. I think that this proposal provides a lot of opportunities for young people. Firstly, politicians will represent the ideas of young people if we can vote, and that's an issue I raise in my article, is that politicians represent constituencies, but youth are not part of any constituency. So how can we really expect to be listened to? And I think the decisions currently being made on our economy, resource use, immigration policy directly affect our nation's future and young people's future. So why don't we have a stake in it?
So you think allowing 16-year-olds to vote might actually make sure that politicians better engage with the needs of teenagers?
Yes, I certainly think so.
Caleb, you're, like Rosina, very engaged in politics, political commentary in the public sphere. Do you think 16-year-olds like yourself should be granted the right to vote?
Well, I mean, you have to look at the fact that there are some 16-year-olds that are, you know, deadly interested, people like me and so on, but there are also a lot of kids that aren't interested and really couldn't give a stuff. And the problem you have is that if you want to extend the vote to another group of people, you need to first ensure that it's going to be a worthwhile activity. And at the moment, I'm not sure that there are enough young people interested in order to do it. We first need to spark that interest, then we can talk about lowering the voting age.
Caleb, don't you think, though, that perhaps giving 16-year-olds the vote might motivate them to become more politically engaged, because politicians might be more motivated to engage with them?
Well, I'm not so sure that it would. I think you first need to plant that seed. I mean, I think of at school, there are certain things that do interest you and certain things that don't. Now, algebra is one thing that annoys the hell out of me.
Oh!
But if I hadn't been taught algebra at school, I probably would never have even considered it. And so if you adopt some sort of political education into the curriculum as a part of years 8, 9 and 10, then I think you'd get students that become interested in politics and then you give them the vote. I think that would be a much better solution to a problem we have, which is political illiteracy.
Rosina Yadav, your response to Caleb's concern?
Well, I attended the YMCA New South Wales Youth Parliament earlier this year, and that showed me that there are many young people who would love the chance. I think a lack of engagement is due to the fact that young people don't have a clear avenue to contribute, so the attitude is, why bother? But I definitely think the idea that Caleb has raised with education about politics and civics and our political system is important, and that could really help. But I think lowering the voting age is a move that would actually get young people involved.
What do you think, though, Rosina, drives the policy views of the average 16-year-old, if there is an average 16-year-old? Some would ask, is it simply the views of their parents rather than anything else at this stage of their life? Would they essentially be clones of their parents at the ballot box?
Oh, I think definitely parents would have an influence, because that's the family environment you're growing in, and that's that impacts your socialisation. But 16 is also a point where you are preparing yourself for adulthood and independence, and political and general awareness are important factors in that. So I think at 16 you start to form a view about the world around you, and you're making your own decisions. Like Bill Shorten said, you can work, you can drive, make independent decisions about healthcare. So you start to form your own views on everything. And I think the ideas of your parents have less of an impact than, say, when you were 12 or 13 or 14.
Caleb, Bill Shorten has said that we're saying to Australia's young people, we trust you. Is trust the issue here in deciding to grant 16-year-olds the vote?
Well, partly it is. I mean, when you're talking about trust, in order to trust someone to do something, you first must understand that they know how to do it. I mean, you don't trust someone who's not a qualified mechanic to service your car. And it's much the same here. If we can't ensure that young people understand the system, and we should note at this point that a lot of adults don't understand the system either.
Well, that's a crucial point, isn't it? They don't understand the system and they don't necessarily care to vote much, but they have to because it's compulsory.
Precisely. Now, if you put in political education like I was suggesting before, I think you would actually be able to solve that problem from the ground up, because it's a generational issue. And if you say, from this point onwards, year 8 students from next year are going to learn all of this stuff, then I think you'd find that from now on into the future, you'd have better citizens, politically interested kids, politically interested adults, and you'd have people that understand when they go to the ballot box the ramifications of their vote. And I cannot see that being a bad thing.
The thing is, though, many adults go to the ballot box not understanding the ramifications of their vote. Perhaps the very act of starting earlier, while we've got an educational framework wrapped around us, would be a great learning exercise.
On the condition that they had a curriculum in place. Look, I'm not totally averse to the idea of young people voting, but they need to do certain things first, like education, in order to make sure that people know what they're doing. If we put those things in place, those safe measures, I suppose you could say, then it's probably not a terrible idea.
Mm. Rosina, many 18 and 19-year-olds, yep, they've got the vote. Mm-hmm. They aren't even enrolled to vote, though. And certainly if voting wasn't compulsory, many Australian adults would probably turn their backs on the whole thing too.
Yeah.
Are you sure that 16 and 17-year-olds are itching to head to a polling booth on a Saturday?
Oh, well, I wouldn't say itching is quite the word, but I think the low numbers associated with 18 and 19-year-olds, as George Williams has also outlined in The Age, can be accredited due to a lack of engagement at 16 and 17, and because at 18, you are not at a very stable point in one's life. You may be moving from home, seeking employment, going overseas, starting university. So there are numerous inhibitors, but if we get young people involved from an earlier point, such as 16, they are more likely at 18 and 19 to understand that they can contribute through being able to vote to society, and they will take that seriously.
What sorts of main policy areas do you think that young people would want to have a say on?
Education and youth affairs are the main ones, in my opinion. Young people should be involved in the development of the education system and curriculum because that affects us on a day-to-day basis. In terms of youth affairs, I don't see who better than young people to provide insight into the issues we face. I think often we see a disconnect between legislators and their target groups. This rings especially true for young people. So issues such as mental health, youth smoking, drinking and drug abuse, as well as future employment, climate change and first home ownership, need the ideas of young people to be effectively solved.
Some might argue, though, that you need a slightly longer lens on life to get perspective on some of those crucial issues, rather than voting on them while you're in the thick of it.
Yeah, that's an issue a lot of people have raised, actually, especially as I've been reading the comments on my article. But I think what a lot of people, especially adults who are raising this, aren't realising that at 16, of course, we haven't experienced a lot that they have, and our life has been very short to this point. But we have been introduced to a lot of things through our education, through our schooling, through our socialisation, through the media, because we live in an age where information is so readily available to us. It's such a globalised and interconnected world that young people really do have the ideas. And if we compare to young people today, to the generations previously, we have a lot more political and general awareness. So I think we would be ready for this sort of responsibility.
Joining us this morning on the question of whether the voting age should be taken back to 16 is Rosina Yadav, Year 10 student at Merriweather High in the New South Wales Hunter Valley. Caleb Bond is with us. He's a final year student at the Heights School in Adelaide, both very politically engaged 16-year-olds. Caleb, what issues do you think you'd vote on if you were given the vote? Let's talk hypothetically here.
Well, I'd probably vote on issues like the economy and such. I think most of my friends would probably vote on social issues because I think when you look at the political landscape, the issues that are at the fore for young people at the moment are social issues like same-sex marriage, these sort of, you know, pinnacle issues, changes in society. I think that would take a young person's interest far more than, you know, boring things like the economy. But being a boring person, they appeal to me.
Why do they appeal to you? What has motivated you to become politically engaged, to establish yourself as a public voice in the political arena at age 16?
Well, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure. I think there are some things that just click in people's brains, you know. It just, you wake up in the morning and you go, yeah, that makes sense. And a lot of people find this with all sorts of different things. You know, some people just, science clicks. But for me, I think it's just politics. And when you look at politics, it, regardless of what anything you do in your life, politics touches every single facet of it. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about water or food or anything. Politics is involved. So I think you have to have an understanding, well, not necessarily have to, but it helps to have an understanding and an interest in that level of it in order to understand the rest of the world.
Was there any one trigger in your life, though? Was it a parent? Was it a teacher? Was it an early obsession with reading political news? What was the trigger?
Well, I think it started quite early. I'm not entirely sure where, but I mean, my mind goes back to being in, I don't know, maybe about year five or six or something, and the school library got a book called The Prime Ministers of Australia. And I remember picking that up and flicking through it and reading with interest. So I think it's been there for quite a while.
Do you see a political career for yourself down the track? Many career politicians there. You're at the end of year 12.
Probably not. Politics is a dirty business. And I'm not sure whether I'd be quite cut out for towing a party line or anything like that. So I am much happier to stand from the sidelines at the moment and tell them how they're doing it wrong.
Well, we might see you on Breakfast Radio at some point in a full-time role. Rosina Yadav, what about you? What has really got you politically motivated at 16?
I think it started, yeah, as with Caleb in year 5 and 6. We had Parliament in as a facet of our class on Thursday mornings. And so we could apply for positions. And one time I think I was the Prime Minister. And it was very interesting leading the committee and, you know, liaising with your ministers to address different issues that the opposition would ask. But as Caleb has said, it's also the idea that politics plays such an important role in our society. And I think as I started reading, you know, publications such as the Sydney Morning Herald, The Guardian, I realised that, you know, I do have an interest in these things, and that's somewhere that I could see myself in the future.
Yeah, but it's one thing to have an interest, it's another to actually write for those newspapers as you do.
Yes, it is. I think when you apply that interest and you realise that you can use your voice to make a difference, that's when you start writing and actually engaging within the current affairs atmosphere and making a contribution.
Well, I can imagine that there's a whole lot of Rosinas and Calebs out there itching to have their say in the political realm, and maybe voting for 16-year-olds is a good idea. Thank you for joining us both. Good luck with the exam, Caleb.
Thank you very much.
May it go well. And Rosina Yadav, thank you very much for joining us there at Merriweather High.
Thank you for having me.
And indeed, good luck to Rosina too, who sits her Year 10 English exam today at Merriweather High School in Newcastle. Caleb Bond in Year 12 at the Height School, joining us from Adelaide. He's sitting his final year psychology exam this morning. And we've linked to their writing, their work, on the Life Matters website, abc.net.au/rn, and look for Life Matters. Love to hear from you on our Facebook page about this one. Do you think that 16-year-olds should get the vote? Love to hear from 16-year-olds on our Facebook page about this. Spread the word to your peers and friends and get talking to us. You can tweet us at RN Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. Yes, with Life Matters across the nation. On ABC RN, one passionate soul about to be unleashed on the airwaves.
You got the whole world in your hands.
ABC News Digital, giving you access to news from here at home and around the globe.
You got the whole world.
When news breaks, the ABC puts the biggest stories in your hands when you want them. All from Australia's most trusted source, abc.net.au/news.
The whole world in your hands.
Yes, get ready to hear Passion Unleashed from a man who reaches millions worldwide with his TV series, The Wildlife of Tim Faulkner. But he's passionately local in his mission. Tim Faulkner has just been named Conservationist of the Year by the Australian Geographic Society. He's General Manager of the Australian Reptile Park, amongst countless other roles. He also manages the Devil Ark Project, an effort to save the Tasmanian devil population from what looks like impending extinction. The Tassie devil's population has declined by 96% over the past 20 years, 96%. He knows more than most about Australia's native animals, but a recent trip, his first overseas, in fact, triggered a profound realisation for him, and it might for you too. Tim joined me a little earlier from our ABC Central Coast studio in New South Wales, which is not far from his Australian Reptile Park, which you can see on the hill if you've ever driven along the Princes Highway that way, and I welcomed him to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations. What a gong.
Oh, thank you. I'm very proud. Not quite as proud as I think my parents are, but very special.
You've had some wild adventures in your time. Your TV show reaches a mega global audience, and yet you've just been overseas for the very first time this year in your life. What epiphany did that trigger in you? Where'd you go?
I went to Borneo, Malaysian Borneo, and I'm very well travelled in Australia. I just could never find a good enough reason to go overseas because there was always somewhere here that I hadn't been. I couldn't draw myself away, but I had an itch that needed scratching and I went to Borneo. I had an amazing time, a wonderful place, very good people, wildlife, just spectacular. But the epiphany was that reflecting upon Australia, I couldn't figure out how in this country, an impoverished country of Borneo, that I'd heard only negative stories of palm oil, deforestation, disappearing wildlife, poaching. I saw the closest thing I'd ever see to megafauna, pygmy jungle elephants, large species of cat, great apes, 199 species of bird, reptiles of every description, 35 species of mammal.
Describe some of those encounters for us.
Oh, well, I mean, the pygmy jungle elephants were, I was at Sukau on the Kingabatan River, and it's just my wife and I with a guide in a small little motorised boat. I've never been overseas, yes, so I've not seen elephants on the African savannas, and we hear elephants trumpeting, but the forest is so dense that it comes all the way to the edge of the river. And so we're sort of, motoring along very slowly by ourselves, middle of nowhere, and you start and get glimpses of colour through the forest. But it's not until the elephants are 30 metres away that you can see them as they break the vegetation. And then the first encounter was 30 elephants come down to the edge of the river and swim across it in front of us. It was spectacular. And, and albeit 300 metres from that, there's an orangutan up a tree just with a mouthful, gums full of fruit, figs, just chomping away. And it was 35 mammals, most of which were daytime encounters, from shrews, badgers, otters, civets, primates, just unbelievable.
So it was awesome.
It was awesome.
And you expected something very different.
Well, I expected for it to be tough. Australia is harsh, and whilst I've been lucky enough to see so much wildlife here, you're normally putting in the effort for one species, just to have an encounter or to know that it's near you. Whereas there, I know we were on with a guide that had local information, but all the same, I'm local here and I can't see 35 species of mammal in a couple of days. It's just not possible. And still, the megafauna of clouded leopards and orangutans and jungle elephants and just incredible.
So you would expect to come back feeling excited by that awesome, spectacular adventure and those encounters. And in fact, you came back feeling sad in some way.
I did. I felt sad there, to tell you the truth. I had a great time, I must admit. It was just, when my mind wanders at night, that reflection to, how on earth today did I see a diurnal squirrel, a diurnal civet, a diurnal badger, a species of otter, four primates, particularly the mammals is where it hit home the hardest. How on earth did I do that? And, our land down under that's meant to be intact, remote, robust, pristine. You go to the hot spots for our wildlife and you still can't find them. And I don't think that's a credit to their ability to hide as much as they're genuinely rare and disappearing by the day. And so that reflection really hit home. And the numbers that drew, I'm learning along the way that, there's 30,000 orangutans in the wild. And people say that with a last gasp. And I think, but hold on. There's only 10,000 devils. There's less than 1,000 numbats, bilbies, northern hairy-nosed wombats, orange-bellied parrots, swift parrots, and the list goes on, and I couldn't compute that.
There was a paradox for you. Your sense is that Australians get behind campaigns to save some of those superstar species overseas, like orangutans, but those unique species here on this continent don't get public attention in the way that they should.
Yeah, spot on. And that's not a criticism on the Australian public either. I think we are, you know, shown keystone species, and we do support and get behind, and we see our wildlife as our identity, national cultural identity, and we really do get behind it. And I mean, if I showcase in a TV program a little obscure, you know, Western Australian marsupial, people are amazed. You know, I didn't even know that existed. And that there is the point, that we know our iconic species, but we're not exposed enough to our obscure species, which often are the ones that are right about to fall off the face of the earth.
Tim Faulkner is with us on Life Matters this morning. He is the winner of the Australian Geographic Society's Conservationist of the Year Award. And a recent trip to Borneo has really galvanised his sense of the plight of Australian species. I mean, you've been working with wildlife since you were just 14. And we'll get to the Tassie Devil, but you hold ambassador roles in initiatives for koalas, quokkas, dingoes. You're general manager of the Australian Reptile Park, a very particular private zoo focused on reptiles. And so this trip's really kind of refocused your local efforts in some way.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, I've always had the local ambitions, and it just reaffirmed them that they really do need our help. Some of our species are in such bad states that when you hear there's 10,000 of a species left, you sort of think it's a good thing. But it's not. And what a stark realisation when you hear that there's 30,000 of a species like orangutan left in the wild. It really rams home. We're clutching at straws saying our numbat population's just hit 1,000. That's not good.
The Tassie Devil has been a big focus for you. Why?
Oh, you know, half intentional and half by, you know, accident and capitalising on opportunities that were there. You know, remember seeing illustrations and stories on Tasmanian devils as a kid, you know, family readings at home of Australian Geographics. And then I started work at a wildlife organisation at 14 and a half. Mm. And one of the species there that grabbed my attention were devils. And they did that because of their personalities. They're very unique. They're all individuals, different personalities, different characters. And once you've worked with animals for a few years, that type species is very stimulating because it's different every day. Every individual is different, and so it's very rewarding. And then the disease came along 1996, and by 2003, regional zoo bodies were talking about insurance populations, and the reptile park was in there in the first instance. 2006, we received the first insurance population devils to come to mainland. And the rest is history, essentially.
So you've set up the Devil Ark Project. And the disease that's killing the Tassie devils, of course, is that horrific facial tumour disease. You've been a strong advocate for the reintroduction of the Tassie devil onto mainland Australia. Not everyone agrees with you. What's your rationale?
Well, my rationale is a simple one, and that's shared of the Reptile Park and Devil Ark's rationale, and that is that there is an academic, Australian ecologist, consistent view that this could be good for Australian ecology. In the absence of top-order predators like dingoes that have been forcibly removed and eradicated, to my dismay, fox and cats are continuing to ravage our wildlife. So realistically, you know, we do this conservation work because we believe in it and we love it. And when extra opportunities pop up on top of what we're already doing for the devil and the Save the Devil program, we want in. It's a no-brainer. An innovative science and a trial reintroduction to mainland of sterilised devils means, you know, they can't get out of control in the first instance. Hopefully there's a point at which we want them to get out of control. But we want in. We want bang for buck. And we believe in innovative science. And anything that could be and prospectively is good for Australian wildlife and ecology, we want in.
Interesting. So we could see Tassie devils roaming our, you know, byways and highways.
Well, let's hope so. And, I mean, the Tasmanian initiatives that are being undertaken for securing the devil in the wild in Tasmania, fundamentally important. Devil Ark has 165 devils as we speak today, 25 of which are returning to Tasmania to the Tasman Peninsula on the 18th of this month. So we're really supportive of the Tasmanian initiatives, but we believe there's more that can be done. And, you know, the mainland ecologists and Tasmanian ecologists that are supportive of the ideal of devils returning to mainland, they're the best and brightest, have spent their lives studying Australian ecology and have watched our small mammals in particular disappear.
Just to get a sense, though, of how that would work, that introducing Tassie devils, sterilised Tassie devils into mainland Australia, what's the mechanism by which they become a predator? Do they attack the cats and foxes?
Sure.
Do they control the offspring of feral animals? Describe how you would see it working.
Yeah, I can only give you that in my opinion, because it is hypothetical, I guess. So, you know, there are examples like when wolves were returned to Yellowstone National Park in the States. Controversial, met with a lot of reservations initially, now hailed as one of the world's greatest reintroductions. There's a brilliant little video called How the Wolves Changed the Water. And the wolves predating on large ungulates had an effect on the rivers and flora around it, in turn having a byproduct effect on fish and aquatic life. And you look at dingoes in Australia, you know, it's common fact now where there are dingoes, there are fewer foxes and cats. And dingoes work in packs. They take down things like emus, kangaroos, large herbivores and graziers. Mm. So the by-effect is that they protect the critical weight range fauna 5 kilos or under. Now, devils, fair to say, they're not good predators. They're a 44-gallon drum with short little legs. They're bush cleaners. They don't have impacts on agriculture. We should be able to get along with them better than some people have dingoes. So the effect that they could have on fox and cats is, I think that if a fox, cat and devil come face to face, there'll be an uneasy truce. I think the fox might be quicker, but the devil is stronger, and I don't think there'll be predation of those ferals by devils. However, devils as marsupials carry their young in a pouch through the vulnerable times, whereas fox and cats den their pups and kittens from day one, and they stink. So devils hypothetically can sniff them out very easily and predate their young, and in turn have an effect. And it's no coincidence, in my opinion, that in Tasmania, something is still going very right until recent years, in that the mainland, we've lost, extinct, the eastern quoll. It's common, was common in Tasmania. Eastern barred bandicoot, extinct on mainland, still in Tasmania. Brush-tailed bedong, extinct on mainland, still present in Tasmania. Mm-hmm. Something's going right there. They say that foxes were introduced to Tasmania, but they've never been able to establish. Well, guess why? And cats have always been kept in check and never got to numbers that we see on mainland. Guess why?
You think it's the Tassie devil's work?
A lot of people think it's the Tassie devil's work. It's a very, very rational explanation. And so if we can have a little bit of that here on the mainland and improve our ecology and also bolster devil numbers, there's only 10,000 left disappearing by the day. Let's do it.
Yeah, so you're doing it with the Devil Ark Project. Before I come to that, your main opposition, in fact, to this proposal apparently is from the Tassie government. Why have they put up such strong resistance, do you think?
It's realistically the only opposition. And the resistance, look, they see the devil as state identity and value. You know, there's a fair bit of parochialism there. And, you know, it's also good because when someone, a state, for example, cares so much about a species, it would hopefully mean that we're not going to lose them as well. So I do credit that. But their foresight is that at present it might detract from current initiatives. And, you know, our worry is that an awful lot of money has been spent on devils. We're 20 years later.
They're still dying.
They're still dying. You know, that needs to broaden itself and look for greater opportunities. So I think that time, you know, as I say, the best and brightest Australian ecologists are all in favour. And it'll just take time before, you know, they come around.
So the Devil Ark Project that you're running is a large-scale conservation breeding facility for Tassie devils there in the beautiful Barrington Tops of New South Wales. That's a radical effort in many ways, isn't it? And I'm wondering how you ensure that population of Tassie devils will be protected from the facial tumour disease.
Yeah, Devil Ark came about. John and Robin Weigel, who are owner-directors of Reptile Park and Devil Ark, they were heavily invested in Tassie devils. And the Reptile Park, be it a medium-sized zoological organisation, by 2009, we had 50 devils. It was more than any other organisation on mainland Australia, and we're a private. And it became apparent that devils are still disappearing in the wild. These devils in zoos cost a lot of money because you're managing one devil at a time, about $10,000 an average per devil. Do that by 500 devils in the population over 20 years, and, you know, the costs are extraordinary. And regionally, the zoos were almost full, and the insurance population full at, 300 devils. Not enough. It's a numbers game. If we're to preserve 95% of the existing genetic variation of the species over 30 years, more is better. So we needed cost efficiency, greater numbers, and devils that weren't losing their behavioural traits because of interaction with people so often. So we had the idea to go in search of land. We put advertisements out in the Land newspaper and anyway, got a brilliant property in the Barrington Tops, 500 hectares, largely intact, just north of the World Heritage Area. And thus far, we've fenced in 25 hectares, around about 15 enclosures. To give you an idea of the scale, the smallest is 3 hectares, 6 football fields in size, heavily vegetated.
So they're roaming free.
They're roaming free. And that's why they're now suitable for wild harvest, to return to wild, because they're, you know, they haven't turned into Staffordshire Terriers like devils can in zoos. They're wild and very healthy. And, you know, the cost efficiency of managing them large scale like that, at no compromise to mental health or physical health, in fact, enhancement, we get away now $1,500 per devil per year. A bang for buck over a 20 to 30 year period, that's the type of viability that's needed. So cost efficiency, behavioural integrity, you know, and numbers. We're 165 devils. That's 30% of all devils existing within captivity. It's a very impressive feat.
Wow, but you're not allowed to release them yet.
No, you know, we are returning to Tasmania, as I say, on the 18th of this month. But at the minute, we're in a holding pattern of ensuring. I mean, remember, it's not just us building numbers so we've got more devils. The ideal of the program is that there's X amount of genetic variation of the species. We need to retain that in captivity. Now, if you've only got few devils, you will lose that because you're not able to breed enough to retain it. So the more means better retention of the genetic variation, and that's why we need thousands of devils, not hundreds.
For you, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Long-distance runners, not sprinters. You said it.
And the thing is, you've just got to keep that facial tumour disease off the mainland, and that is the challenge.
Yeah, it is a challenge. However, I think that the Tasmanians there have done a wonderful job of that. It's sad what I'm about to say, but the disease is incredibly aggressive. From contraction, 3 months it expresses itself, 6 months they're always dead. So quarantining of devils, of founders that have come in from the wild, it's a reasonably easy process because the disease is so aggressive. So by the time the devils come to mainland, they're not plucked from the bush and sent up to mainland. There are strict protocols that are undertaken, and you know, there's been hundreds of devils that have come to the mainland, never a case of DFTD. So it's quite manageable in that perspective.
In fact, though, I didn't know this, but devils were once native on the mainland only a few thousand years ago, and that's just a drop in the ocean in evolutionary time.
It's a blink, that's right.
I mean, why do we know why they went extinct on the mainland in the first place?
No, and again, you know, I'm regurgitating information here, but it's down to, it seems to me, most practically one of three things, and that was Aboriginal pressure. Probably not, because the Aboriginals have been here a long time, pre-devils disappearing. The pressure of dingoes that arrived 5,000 years ago through northern Australia and made their way down. No coincidence, the Bass Strait filled with water 12,000 years ago, so dingoes never got to Tasmania. And number three is climate change. But devils had been here for a long time through many environmental changes, from deserts to ice ages, etc. So, you know, not sure. Perhaps the dingo was a factor there. But, you know, 1 to 5,000 years ago they were here, as you said, an ecological blink in time. That's why talking about a devil reintroduction to mainland, it's a reintroduction. We're not talking about an introduction of a fox, toad, pig, buffalo, donkey, cat. This is a native species that was here not so long ago and fits in with our ecology.
You'd hope so, but it's still an experiment. And just finally, back to, I guess, the original premise of this discussion, how do you get people to care? Because they're going about their busy days, and those little creatures around them, well, we're oblivious in the moment.
Yep, inherently, I think that people do care, and I think that about our iconic wildlife, Australians care very much. We're just not exposed to the obscure species that often need most help. So I'll give you an example with the devils. We took devils up to the Barrington Tops, you know, and it's in agricultural country. Funny examples were, before the devils were on site at Devil Arc through building, a fella at the pub tells me, I saw devil footprints in the creek today. I said, well, that's funny because they're not here yet. Another one. Another
it's in their imagination.
That's right. But people that had some fears and reservations, you know, the agricultural community like that, they do their homework and they realise that something like a devil, hold on, so they don't pose a threat to agriculture in Tasmania. They're not, you know, eating small children while they sleep. And now we've got community in the North Barrington's from Scone, Gloucester and across that are in love with the devil. They're its greatest advocates. And you know, what a transition in a 2 to 3 year period. I think that's the point is if we can educate people and make prominent, more obscure, less iconic species, they fall in love with it. It's just that species needs the exposure.
Yeah, and hopefully not just the really cute species that we can teach our children about. You know, some of those, I don't know, like that amazing albino marsupial mole that lives underground and, you know, some of those little creatures that are less sexy.
Yeah, certainly. And if, you know, my little TV program, it's only filmed in Australia and it showcases a lot of Australian mammals. Now, the catch with them is they're really difficult to film, but you get to meet wonderful people that are often in projects that are trapping, monitoring, and, you know, the people you meet and the backstories of those species are the real deal. They're on the coalface. They love what they're doing. And, you know, you have a look at those programs and they showcase obscure Australian wildlife, whether it's amphibians, seabirds, mammals, marsupials, reptiles. It's tough and tricky when you're not filming a lion, a tiger or a bear, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
Ah, oh, you're passionate. And congratulations on winning Conservationist of the Year. I can see why. Thank you, Tim, for joining us on Life Matters today.
My pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
Tim Faulkner, General Manager of the Australian Reptile Park, and the 2015 Conservationist of the Year, as announced by the Australian Geographic Society. And what do you reckon? If you're in Tassie, do you think Tassie devils should be released on the mainland? If you're on the mainland, do you think Tassie devils should be bred and released widely? And interesting case that he makes. So, love to hear from you on our Facebook page, or you can email us from our website, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Up next, everyday economics. Are you ready for an increase in GST? Is it on its way?
Battling boredom.
There's something ridiculous about yelling at a little girl. You don't get to be bored. I mean, she's not going to say, oh, you're right, now that you mention it.
We've an orangutan, in all honesty, all they're going to do is just go to sleep.
The first women who came to Australia probably found it even more boring than the men.
Kids, convicts and animals. Who gets to be bored? Join me, Susan Mousehart, for Fun with Boredom.
You taught yourself that during the holidays?
There wasn't that much to do.
Why don't you binge the whole series now?
Yes, suddenly it's real. There's now an extremely high chance that an increase in the goods and services tax will be put to the next election, and a high chance it will pass into law should the coalition win. Until a few months ago, it might have been a safe bet nothing would change. Several of the states were promising to veto any change. The coalition perhaps lacked the political collateral to bring about a change. Now, that's not the case, it would seem. According to our everyday economist, Peter Martin, economics editor of The Age, Victoria has effectively lifted its threat of veto, saying that while it opposes an increase in GST, it won't stand in the way of a proposal. So if it's approved at a federal election. So what are we in store for on the GST front? Peter Martin, good morning.
Good morning. Isn't it, you know that feeling when something becomes real, like, you know, you can debate about something and then suddenly, oh my gosh, we might actually have to pay 15% on everything and 15% on some things that we don't pay anything on at all, like next year. Oh, no, not next year, probably come into force middle of 2017.
I'm always interested in what drives those changes, and I think that it has a lot to do with narratives in the media. You know, they sort of shift, they persuade, the tone shifts. And certainly there's been a tone shift around Malcolm Turnbull.
Oh, absolutely. Turnbull can, he has the political capital, collateral, you called it, to get away with anything for a while. There's enormous goodwill. Now, the critics of the coalition government might say that's the sort of goodwill you get when, you know, someone stops bashing your head against a wall. But for whatever reason, people are prepared to trust what he has to say. So,
are we really that persuadable?
In the building in which I work, which, by the way, is atypical, which is Parliament House. There is and everyone says it in every part of the building, just a feeling of, you know, you did a thesis, right, at university?
Nope, packed it when, in, quit
okay,
a PhD.
Well, okay, when you finished your thesis, I only did an honours thesis.
Just for, yeah, honours thesis, yeah. Engineering.
Okay, well, when you finish it, there's this incredible feeling. I don't know if you've had it, but...
maintain your journalistic scepticism, Peter Martin. What's the current central proposal in relation to GST? Is it going to be
15%?
Not 12.5?
Nah, why bother? Now, this isn't necessarily a good idea, but you talked about momentum, and I suppose also there are forces on the Turnbull government to, if you like, pushing them to do something. You can't coast along being popular by not being what was there before forever. So 15%, now that won't be the end of it. There are a number of exemptions which could be removed. 15%, by the way, just that, not just that, raises a lot of money, $26 billion per year, okay?
That's with existing, as it
yeah,
exists
with the existing
now.
Exemptions,
so
yeah.
what do you suspect it might be extended to, and what's the evidence that that might be the case?
Health, this is private hospitals, that sort of thing. That's each of these I mentioned are roughly an extra, with the 15%, an extra $5.5 billion. Education, private schools, that sort of thing. Financial services, insurance, banking, that's an extra, $5.5 billion. It adds up, those add up to $42 billion a year. Now, that's roughly half the education budget. No, it's half the health budget, and it's roughly the same as what's spent on education. So it's a very serious chunk of money. Of course, we'll feel it. It'll hurt. But it will give the government the ability to cope with the situation where the deficit now is that much. The deficit's $35 billion. It'll give the government the ability to reduce that to some extent. It'll give the government the ability to ensure that it can fund hospitals.
You just don't know how they would use that extra revenue. And certainly they've been burnt politically on the basis of budgets that were perceived to be unfair. And the GST, according to many, if you increase it, that would be unfair. So wouldn't lot be perhaps spent on compensating those who would be most affected?
It is beyond doubt that increasing the GST is unfair. Sort of notional figures are that if someone in the bottom one-fifth of income earners would pay maybe 6% more, someone in the top one-fifth of earners would pay less than 2% more. No doubt about it, for fairly obvious reasons. High earners tend to spend overseas, and they spend to save. They save rather than spend. It'd be rather hard if you're a very high earner to spend everything you earn, but impossible to do otherwise if you were a low earner. So compensation is needed. Compensation is difficult, to tell you the truth. It was easier the first time. What they did last time was increase family benefits, increase pensions, and cut tax. Mm. Back then it worked. It worked fairly well because very few Australians were beneath the tax-free threshold. Mm. The tax-free threshold then was, they increased it then to $6,000. The threshold's now nearer to $20,000. It's $18,000. That means there's a lot of people who are going to fall through the cracks. They won't have children. There'll be low earners. They won't be in receipt of the pension. So cutting pension, family benefits isn't going to help them. You can't cut their tax.
And they'll be paying more through GST, through their purchasing.
Now, there are two responses to that conundrum. One is to say you could have a negative income tax. I don't think that will come in. The other is to say these people don't matter. Now, that sounds harsh, but there's a view that there are very few people in the bottom, you know, of earnings who are actually poor and not on the pension or receiving family benefits. The stereotype is doctors' wives. They needn't be doctors' wives, but there are a lot of people who are that poor precisely because they don't need to work. So that's one view that you don't need to compensate.
Well, when I hear a figure like one in six children are living under the poverty line in Australia, I have to be sceptical about that. No.
Those people will be compensated. Increases in family benefits. They're not the problem. It's people without children and people not in receipt of government benefits who are nonetheless on low income.
Thinking about what it might be expanded to cover, what about fresh food? Will that stay off the table?
Yes. Fresh food, of all of the things you could do, fresh food is clearly regressive. It's not going to happen. Forget about it. Health and education, also financial services, water and sewerage perhaps, these are things which aren't taxed with the GST at the moment. This is where it will be. Some of the research tends to indicate that even our spending on education is... spending on education's not necessarily particularly progressive. You would think that high earners would be the ones who spend on private schools, but not as much as you would think. So, there's an argument for taxing these things. The argument for taxing these things is we're spending more and more on them. So,
well, why don't we go for the Medicare levy option, though? That's an alternative. It's more palatable because it's a means-tested way of raising revenue. It's happened in the past. People seem to have been okay with it. Is that a sufficient way of raising equivalent revenue?
You have cracked it. You are onto it. The Victorian government is onto it. The Medicare levy is a far better thing to do. The Medicare levy, people earning less than $20,000 don't pay it. Okay, so you don't need to compensate low earners. Low earners don't pay the Medicare levy. If people on receipt of pensions, old people earning less than $33,000 don't pay it. It's dead simple. We did it last year. No one even remembers it now, but the Medicare levy went up from 1.5% to 2% of income to pay for the or help pay for the National Disability Insurance Scheme. No one seemed to mind. That's simpler. The problem, and it goes back to what you were talking about earlier, it hasn't caught the political imagination. It hasn't caught the journalistic imagination. It's not seen as the sort of innovative thing you do. But if you increase the GST...
Well, GST is a sort of low-hanging fruit in a way, isn't it?
It's very difficult to do, but it's sort of got this politically courageous aura about it. Whereas increasing the Medicare levy seems like a simple administrative thing and yet could solve a lot of those problems.
So where do you think Labor will position itself and where do you think the states will position themselves?
I think the states will want to let it go through because, after all, they're the ones who run the hospital system, right? I don't think they'll use this alleged veto power they have. And the veto the Commonwealth has over that is they don't really have a veto power. They do in law, but the Commonwealth can change the law. So that's a sort of, I think the states will go along with anything if it's passed in the election. Labor will absolutely oppose it in the election. It's positioning itself, was doing it yesterday, as a supporter of private schools and, you know, the battlers who... Nowadays, lots of them send their children to private schools. It even, I think, in jest said that a tax on financial services would hurt punters betting on the Melbourne Cup. That's the level to which Labor's rhetoric has descended. It sees this as a point of difference, and it'll go to the next election with that. It'll almost certainly lose that election, and the states will pass it. So I think we are in for an increase in the GST. Depends how things play out.
Okay.
We've got a green paper and then a white paper early next year, but we'll be hearing lots about it over the next year.
Well, more than GST will be on the table. The tax inquiry's been running since March and everything is on the table, including super, of course. Peter Martin, thank you so much for making time for us today. Great to have you on the show again.
Pleasure.
Our everyday economist, economics editor of The Age, Peter Martin. Is a GST increase inevitable? Has the rhetoric changed? Well, Michael Cathcart is in the chair for Books and Arts. You're taking us to Ireland.
Beautiful Ireland. That's right. It's funny you should speak in a funny voice like that, because I've just been thinking if I could...
No offence
it's lovely.
To the Irish.
No, it's lovely. I've been thinking if I could come back, if I had another life, I'd like to lead life number two with an Irish accent.
You'd get all the girls.
Do you reckon? Unlike the lonely life I now have.
No.
Well, you've got the girl.
I got the girl.
I got the lovely girl. I did very well without an Irish accent. I wooed her with my Aussie accent. Anyway, we're going to talk about Irish theatre. We're going to meet some Irish makers of theatre, or makers of Irish theatre, and they're in Dublin and they'll talk a bit like that.
You see, those accents. Oh, you can do it much better than I. Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart. It's 10 a.m. Ciao.